World History, Modern Times, Chapter 1, Section 3, India and China. Early Civilization in India. India is a land of diversity. Today, about 110 languages and more than 1,000 dialects, varieties of language, are spoken in India. Diversity is also apparent in India's geography. The Indian subcontinent, shaped like a triangle hanging from the southern ridge of Asia, is composed of a number of core regions, including mountain ranges, river valleys, a dry interior plateau, and fertile coastal plains. As in Mesopotamia, Egypt, early civilization in India emerged in river valleys. Between 3000 BC and 1500 BC, the valleys of the Indus River supported a flourishing civilization, and it extended hundreds of miles from the Himalaya, the highest mountains in the world, to the coast of the Arabian Sea. Archaeologists have found the remains of more than 1,000 settlements in this region. Today, two of the ruins, about 400 miles apart, were sites of what once were the major cities of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. An advanced civilization known as Harappan or Indus civilization flourished in these cities for hundreds of years. The arrival of the Aryans, eventually floods, an earthquake, changes in climate, and even a change in the course of the Indus River weakened the once flourishing civilization in the Indus River Valley. Invaders brought its final end. Around 1500 BC, a group of Indo-European nomadic peoples began to move out of their original homelands in Central Asia. Known as the Aryans, they moved south across the Hindu Kush mountain range into the plains of northern India. They invaded and conquered the Harappans and created a new Indian society based on Aryan culture and institutions. Like other nomadic peoples, the Aryans excelled in the art of war. Between 1500 and 1000 BC, the Aryan peoples gradually advanced eastward from the Indus Valley across the fertile plain of the Ganges River. Later, they moved southward into the Deccan Plateau. Eventually, they extended their control throughout all of India. Society in ancient India. The conquest by the Aryans had a lasting impact on Indian society. Out of the clash between conqueror and conquered came a set of social institutions and class divisions that has lasted in India, with only minor changes to the present day. The caste system of ancient India was a set of rigid social categories that determined not only a person's occupation and economic potential, but also his or her position in society. There were five major divisions in Indian classes, known as castes in English, in ancient times. The priestly class, whose members were known as the Brahman, was usually considered to be at the top of the social scale. They were in charge of the religious ceremonies that were so important in Indian society. The second caste was the Kshatriyas, or warriors. The third ranked caste in Indian society was the Vaishya, or commoner. The Vaishya were usually the merchants who engaged in commerce. Below these three castes were the Sudras, who made up the great bulk of the Indian population. Most Sudras were peasants, artisans, or people who worked at other forms of manual labor. They had only limited rights in society. At the lowest level of Indian society, and in fact not even considered a real part of the caste system, were the Untouchables. The Untouchables probably made up about 5% of the total population of ancient India. The Untouchables were given menial, degrading tasks that other Indians would not accept, such as collecting trash and handling dead bodies. They were not considered human, and their very presence was considered harmful to members of the other classes. Reading check, summarizing. What are the names of the castes in Indian society? Hinduism. Two of the world's great religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, began in India. Hinduism had its origins in the religious beliefs of the Aryan peoples who settled in India after 1500 BC. Evidence about the religious beliefs of the Aryan people comes from the Vedas, a collection of hymns and religious ceremonies that were passed down orally through the centuries by Aryan priests and then eventually written down. Early Hindus believed in the existence of a single force in the universe, a form of ultimately reality or God called Brahman. It was the duty of the individual self, called the Atman, to seek to know the ultimate reality. By doing so, the self would merge with Brahman after death. In the 6th century BC, the idea of reincarnation had appeared in Hinduism. Reincarnation is the belief that the individual soul is reborn in a different form after death. After a number of existences in the earthly world, the soul reaches its final goal in the union with Brahman. Important to this process is the idea of karma, the force generated by a person's actions that determines how the person will be reborn in the next life. According to this idea, what people do in the current lives determines what they will be in the next life. In the same way, a person's current status is not simply an accident. It is the result of the person's action in a past existence. The system of reincarnation provided a religious basis for the rigid class divisions in Indian society. It justified the privileges of those who on the higher end of the scale. After all, they would not have these privileges if they were not deserving. At the same time, the conception of reincarnation gave hope to those lower on the ladder of life. The poor, for example, could hope that if they behaved properly in this life, they would improve their condition in the next. How does one achieve oneness in God? Hindus developed a practice of yoga, a method of training designed to lead to such a union. In fact, yoga means union. The final goal of yoga was to leave behind the cycle of earthly life and achieve union with Brahman, seen as a kind of dreamless sleep. Most ordinary Indians, however, could not easily relate to this ideal and needed a more concrete form of heavenly salvation. It was probably for this reason that the Hindu religion came to have a number of human-like gods and goddesses, including three chief ones: Brahman, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer. Many Hindus regarded the multitude of gods as simply different expressions of the one ultimate reality, Brahman. However, the various gods and goddesses give ordinary Indians a way to express their religious feelings. Hinduism is the religion of the vast majority of the Indian people. Reading check, comparing. How do karma and yoga relate to reincarnation? Buddhism. In the 6th century BC, a new doctrine called Buddhism appeared in northern India and soon became a rival to Hinduism. Buddhism was the product of one man, Siddhartha Gautama. Born around 563 BC, Siddhartha Gautama is better known as the Buddha, or Enlightened One. In his lifetime, Siddhartha gained thousands of devoted followers, people who would come to him seeking to know more about him. They asked, "Are you a god?" "No," he answered. "Are you an angel?" "No." "Are you a saint?" "No." "Then what are you?" The Buddha replied, "I am awake." The religion of Buddhism began with a man who claimed that he had awakened and seen the world in a new way. Siddhartha denied the reality of the material world. The physical surroundings of humans, he believed, were simply illusions. The pain, poverty, and sorrow that afflicted human beings were caused by their attachment to things of this world. Once people let go of their worldly cares, pain and sorrow can be forgotten. Then comes bodhi, or wisdom. The word bodhi is the root of the word Buddhism and of Siddhartha's unusual name, Gautama Buddha. Achieving wisdom is the key step to achieving nirvana, or ultimate reality, and the end of the self and the reunion with the great world soul. Siddhartha preached this message in a sermon to his followers in the Deer Park at Sarnath, outside India's holy city of Banaras. It is a simple message based on the Four Noble Truths. Ordinary life is full of suffering. The suffering is caused by our desire to satisfy ourselves. The way to end suffering is to end desire for selfish goals and to see others as extension of ourselves. And the way to end desire is to follow the middle path. This middle path is also known as the Eightfold Path because it consists of eight steps. Number one, right view. We need to know the Four Noble Truths. Number two, right intention. We need to decide what we really want. Three, right speech. We must seek to speak truth and to speak well of others. Four, right action. The Buddha gave five precepts: do not kill, do not steal, do not lie, do not be unchaste, do not take drugs or drink alcohol. 5. Right livelihood. We must do work that uplifts our being. 6. Right effort. The Buddha said, those who follow the way might well follow the example of the ox that arches through the deep mud, carrying a heavy load. He is tired, but his forward-looking gaze will not relax until he comes out of the mud. Number 7, right mindfulness. We must keep our minds in control of our senses. And number 8, right concentration. We must meditate to see the world in a new way. Siddhartha accepted the idea of reincarnation, but he rejected the Hindu division of human beings in the rigidly defined castes based on previous reincarnations. He taught instead that all human beings could reach nirvana as a result of their behavior in this life. Reading check, contrasting. How does Buddhism differ from Hinduism? New empires in India. For most of the time between 325 BC and 500 AD, India was a land of many different states. Two major empires, however, were able to create large unified Indian states. The first of these empires, the Mauryan Empire of northern India, lasted from 324 to 183 BC. The Mauryan Empire flourished during the reign of Asoka, who ruled from 269 until 232 BC. Asoka is generally considered to be the greatest ruler in the history of India. After his conversion to Buddhism, Asoka used Buddhist ideals to guide his rule. He set up hospitals for both people and animals. He sent missionaries to China and other parts of Asia, thus introducing Buddhism to those areas. Asoka was more than a kind ruler, however. His kingdom prospered as India's role in regional trade began to expand. India became a major crossroads in the vast commercial network. One of the most important parts of that network was a route known as the Silk Road, so called because silk was China's most valuable product. The Silk Road reached from the city of Chang'an in China across Central Asia to Mesopotamia, covering a distance of about 4,000 miles. People used camels to transport goods through the mountains and deserts of the Silk Road, winding up at Antioch, a port city on the Mediterranean Sea. At Antioch, luxury goods from the West were traded for luxury goods from the East, which were then shipped across the Mediterranean to Greece and Rome. After Asoka's death in 232 BC, the Mauryan Empire began to decline, and in 183 BC it collapsed. India then fell into disunity until a new empire arose. This new empire, the Gupta Empire, flourished from 320 AD until the late 5th century, when the invasion of the Huns reduced its power. Reading check, evaluating. Why was Asoka considered a great ruler? Early Chinese civilization. One of the great civilizations discussed so far, China, was the last to come into full flower. By the time the first Chinese dynasty began to emerge as an organized state, the societies in Mesopotamia, Egypt, and India had already reached its advanced level of civilization. One likely reason for China's late arrival was its isolation from the emerging centers of culture elsewhere in the world. Basically, China was forced to develop its own. The Shang Dynasty. The Shang Dynasty, about 750 to 1122 BC, created the first flourishing Chinese civilization. Under the Shang, China developed organized government, a system of writing, and advanced skills in the making of bronze vessels. The Chinese believed they could communicate with supernatural forces to obtain help in worldly affairs. To do so, they made use of oracle bones. These were bones on which priests scratched questions they asked by the rulers, such as, will the king will be victorious in battle? Will the king recover from his illness? Heated metal rods were then stuck into the bones, causing them to crack. The priests interpreted the shapes of the cracks as answers from the gods. The priests wrote down the answers, then the bones were stored. Inscriptions on the bones have become a valuable source of information about the Shang period. The Shao Dynasty. During the Shao Dynasty, 1045 to 256 BC, China began to adopt many of the features that characterized Chinese civilization for centuries. Especially important politically was the mandate of heaven. The Shao Dynasty claimed that it ruled China because it possessed the mandate of heaven. The Shao believed that heaven, which was an impersonal law of nature, kept order in the universe through the Shao King. Thus, they ruled over all humanity by a mandate, or authority to command, from heaven. The king, who was chosen to rule because of his talent and virtue, was then responsible for ruling the people with goodness and efficiency. The mandate of heaven, however, was double-edged. The king was expected to rule during the proper way, called the Dao. It was his duty to keep the gods pleased in order to protect the people from natural disasters or a bad harvest. If the king failed to rule effectively, he could be overthrown and replaced by a new ruler. The mandate of heaven was closely tied to the pattern of dynastic cycles. From the beginning of the Chinese history to 1912, China was ruled by a series of dynasties. The Shao Dynasty, as we have seen, lasted for almost 800 years. Others did not last as long, but the king of each dynasty ruled with the mandate of heaven. No matter how long the dynasties lasted, all went through a cycle of change. A new dynasty established its power, ruled successfully for many years, and then began to decline. The power of the central government would begin to collapse, giving rise to rebellions or invasions. Finally, the dynasty collapsed and a new dynasty took over, beginning yet another dynastic cycle. The Qin Dynasty. The collapse of the Shao Dynasty was followed by 200 years of civil war. A new dynasty, called the Qin, then created an era of Chinese unity. The Qin Dynasty was founded by the Qin Shi Huangdi, meaning the first Qin dynasty. Qin Shi Huangdi, a person of much ambition, unified the Chinese world, but his major foreign concern was in the north. In the vicinity of the Gobi resided a nomadic people known to the Chinese as the Xinnu, who often made raids in the Chinese territory. Qin Shunandi answer to this problem was to strengthen the existing system of walls to keep the nomads out. Today we know Qin Shunandi's project as the Great Wall of China. However, the Great Wall that we knew today from films and photographs was built 1500 years later, after the rule of Qin Shunandi. Some of the walls built by Qin Shunandi do remain standing, but many of them were constructed of loose stone, sand, or piled rubble and disappeared long ago. This is not to say, of course, that Qin Shunandi's wall was not a massive project. It required the efforts of thousands of laborers. Many of them died while working there and, according to legend, are now buried within the wall. The wall enabled the first Qin emperor to enjoy some success in fighting off the threats of the nomads, but the victory was only temporary. The Han Dynasty. The first Qin emperor was also the last of his dynasty. A new dynasty, the Han, then established an empire that lasted over 400 years, 202 BC to 220 AD. China, under the Han Dynasty, was a vast empire. The population increased rapidly, by some estimates rising from about 20 million to over 60 million at the height of the dynasty. The large population created a growing need for a bigger and more efficient bureaucracy to keep the state in proper working order. During the glory years of the Han Dynasty, China extended the boundaries of its empire far into the sands of Central Asia and southward along the coast of the South China Sea into what is modern-day Vietnam. Chinese culture appeared to be unrivaled, and its scientific and technological achievements were unsurpassed. Reading check explaining, why did the first Qin emperor build walls across northern China? The family in ancient China. A few social institutions have been as closely identified with China as the family. As in most agricultural societies in China, ancient China, the family served as the basic economic and social unit. However, the Chinese family took on an almost sacred quality as a symbol of the entire social order. At the heart of the concept of family in China was the idea of filial piety. The word filia refers to a son or daughter. Filial piety then refers to the duty of the members of the family to subordinate their needs and desires to those of the male head of the family. Thus, the term describes a system in which every family member had his or her place. The concept is important in Confucianism, as you will see later in this section. What explains the importance of the family in ancient China? The need to work together on the land, it was a significant factor. In ancient times, as today, farming in China required the work of many people. Children, too, were essential to the family's needs. They worked in the fields during their early years. Later, sons were expected to take over the burden of physical labor on the family plots and provide for the well-being of their parents. Male supremacy was a key element in the social system of ancient China, as it was in the other civilizations that we have examined. The male was considered so important because he was responsible for providing food for the family. In ancient China, men worked in the fields. They also governed society and were the warriors, scholars, and government ministers. Women raised the children and worked in the home. Reading check explaining. Why were males considered to be superior to females in Chinese families? The importance of Confucius. The civilization of China was closely tied to Confucius, in pinyin, Confuzi, a philosopher who lived in the 6th century BC. Confucius traveled the length of China, observing events and seeking employment, as a political counselor. He had little success in his job search and instead became a teacher to hundreds of students who sought his wise advice. Some of his students became ardent disciples of their teacher and recorded his sayings. Until the 20th century, almost every Chinese pupil studied his sayings. This made Confucianism, or the system of Confucian ideas, as important part of Chinese history. Confucius believed that the universe was made in such a way that if humans were to act in harmony with its purposes, their own affairs would prosper. Much of his concern was with human behavior. The key to proper behavior was to behave in accordance with the Tao, or way. Two elements stand out in the Confucian view of the Tao: duty and humanity. The concept of duty meant that all people had to subordinate their own interests to the broader needs of the family and the community. Everyone should be governed by the five constant relationships: parent and child, husband and wife, older sibling and younger sibling, older friend and younger friend, and ruler and subject. Each person in the relationship had a duty to the other. Parents should be loving, and children should revere their parents. Husbands should fulfill their duties, and wives should be obedient. The elder sibling should be kind, and the younger sibling respectful. The older friend should be considerate, and the younger friend deferential. Rulers should be benevolent, and subjects loyal. The Confucian concept of duty is often expressed in the form of the work ethic. And each individual worked hard to fulfill his or her duty, then the affairs of society as a whole would prosper as well. Above all, the ruler must set a good example. If the king followed the path of goodness and the common good, then subjects would respect him and society would prosper. The second key element in the Confucian view of the Tao is the idea of humanity. This consists of a sense of compassion and empathy for others. It is similar in some ways to Christian ideas, but with a twist. Christians are taught, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." Confucius would say, "Do not do unto others what you would not wish done to yourself." Confucians, I urge people to measure the feelings of others by one's own. Reading check, describing. Describe the meaning of duty and humanity in the Confucian view of the Tao.